Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We continue with Open Forum. Carlo Broussard, our guest. The number 888-318-7884. I will stress that open means open to anybody. You can call whether you are a religious person or not a religious person, whether you're a Christian person or not a Christian person. If you've got a question that you'd like to ask a Catholic apologist, maybe about the doctrines of the church, maybe about the moral teaching of the church. Carlo is also a philosopher. You can ask a philosophical question. 888-318-7884. Carlo Broussard, our guest. We just saw him out here in California. It was awful nice, but he's back in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Apologist and author, and among his books, Purgatory is for Real, Good News About the Afterlife for Those Who Aren't Perfect Yet, and his most recent book, The New Relativism. Carlo, welcome.
Hey, Si. Thanks for having me, buddy. It's always great to be with you.
Yeah, it was really fun to get to hang out with you on the weekend when we were with all of our donors.
Yeah, I had a blast. It was great seeing you. It's great hanging out with old Todd Aglioloro there and being with Chris Check and the whole Catholic, well, not the whole, but part of the Catholic Answers team.
Yeah, yeah.
And just being with our Catholic Answers family members and friends, right? It's a Catholic family. Catholic Answers is like a family. And it was just such a blessing hanging out with such good folks. Laughter, fun, entertainment, study. It was just a blast, man.
Did you think that empanada was Mexican food? I know you're never going to think
Man,
it again.
Man, let me tell you something. I think the only trivia question that I got right that night was the sequel to Venom, Carnage.
Yeah, and congratulations on that. You were one of the few who got that correct.
I think that was like the only one I got, man. I am not good at trivia. I have very limited knowledge. So,
well, what I was referring to was that one of the trivia categories was Mexican food. And there's theology categories and women of the Middle Ages categories, and one of them was Mexican food. And out of the five questions I prepared for the Mexican food category, the people who are of Mexican descent or are in fact Mexicans who were there told me I got three of them completely wrong. So it was a little bit of an embarrassment for me. I thought empanada was a Mexican food, and they told me no, it's from Argentina. And Edgar is still mad about it. But did we give you your points?
He's still hooting and hollering.
Yeah, yeah. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You are welcome to call if you have questions about the Catholic faith, whether you're a Catholic or not. And I really like to say, if you don't know anything about religion and you're just curious and you want to ask a question, you are perfect to call. We would love to talk with you. So please do not exclude yourself thinking that this show is for other people. 888-318-7884. And if you have any information about empanadas possibly being a Mexican food that could help me in my argument with Edgar, then that's welcome as well. Shall we go to the phones, Carlo?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's start with Andrea down there in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Andrea, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a question, and I just wanted to tell you, Si, that you've probably heard from me and my husband a lot because he was going through RCIA. It's actually a question for him, for Joshua.
And okay.
So he has this question of, so we baptized all of our kids Catholic, and
I know one of them would like to speak with you right now. I don't know. go ahead.
So we've baptized all our kids Catholic, and his reservation, I guess, or worry is that now that he is Catholic, he's fully Catholic, he doesn't know how to respond to them if they say, well, how come you never gave me a choice? Like, you baptized me as a baby and you kind of like, well, indoctrinated me, for lack of a better term. And, you know, I don't really know what's out there. You didn't ever give me the choice. Like, how does he respond to that? He's like so worried about that now. Like, that's the only thing that he had as a, you know, like a reservation going into really being Catholic was infant baptism. And the only reason is because, well, he got a chance to choose because he just got fully initiated.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a great question. And the answer to the question is going to only be understood once we understand God's setup of this order of providence of how we come into existence and what baptism does for us. Okay, so if we take a step back and we first ask the question, well, what does baptism do for us? Well, when we look at the biblical data as interpreted by the church, we discover that our Lord has given us the sacrament of baptism to communicate something to us that we did not have with our first birth, given this order of providence and technically given the fall of Adam. And that thing we did not have when we come into existence, when we're created, is the supernatural life. We call it sanctifying grace. That's the theological terminology there for heaven. So when we come into existence, when we're born, that's our first birth. We have physical life. That's the life in virtue of which we're related to the first man, Adam. But we're told in divine revelation, the Bible and the teaching of the church, or the Bible and sacred tradition as interpreted by the church, that because Adam sinned, that life that we need to exist in heaven was forfeited for the human race because of Adam's sin. Adam had it. He had a different kind of life, the supernatural life needed for heaven when he was created, sanctifying grace, but he forfeited that gift for all of his descendants, for all of his progeny, because of his original sin. So all of us who are descendants of Adam, we come into existence without this supernatural life, which we call sanctifying grace, and what we need in order to exist in the heavenly existence, in the heavenly realm, okay? And so Jesus comes and reveals to us that we need to be born again in John 3:5. How? By water and spirit. That's baptism. So notice there, Andrea, that according to Jesus, there is something that we did not receive in our first birth that we need to receive in our second birth, i.e. baptism, and that's what we call the supernatural life, what's necessary to exist in heaven. And so we can also go further. 1 Peter 3:21, St. Peter says, baptism now saves you. Saves us from what? Saves us from sin, puts us in union with God, gives us the life of God. But even more clearly, in Romans 6:3-4, St. Paul teaches us, Andrea, that in baptism we die with Christ and we rise to a newness of life. We receive new life, according to Paul. And so here's the point. If we come into existence and we're created without the life that we need to exist in heaven, without the life that puts us in relationship with God and at peace with God, and Jesus tells us that baptism gives that life, well, then it follows that we're going to want to give that life of heaven to our children as infants, even though they're not yet able to exercise their intellect and will to choose God, to know God and to choose him. It's a life that Christ wills to give in order to have peace with God and be in a right relationship with God, to be members of the covenantal family. And so once you have that in place, this lack of sanctifying grace upon our first birth, we call that the state of original sin, and that baptism gives the life to the soul so that we can have the life of heaven, well, then it makes sense that we're going to baptize our infants. Like, and here's the last point, like the covenant of old, where infants could become members of God's covenantal family through the visible sign of circumcision, at least for the males and the females, by way of the males being circumcised. And Paul teaches in Colossians 2:11-12, that there is a new circumcision in town, so to speak, the circumcision of Christ, which for Paul, check it out, is baptism. So like infants came into the covenantal family of God in the old covenant, infants can also become members of God's covenantal family through the sacrament of baptism. And so we ask the question, well, who wouldn't want their infants to become members of God's covenantal family? Who wouldn't want their infants to receive the supernatural life of the second birth that's necessary to exist in the kingdom of heaven? I think any parent who loves their child, knowing this stuff, would want to give that supernatural life that we call sanctifying grace. And so that's a theological explanation as to why we would baptize infants, even though they can't exercise an act of faith. But whenever the child does come to the age of reason and the intellect is activated and is working, the will is free, right, where the child can choose A or B, well, then the child would need to begin to profess faith in Christ consistent with the life that's already dwelling in the soul and begin to live their Christian life in accord with that grace that's already in the soul, to where that faith, as we say in common parlance, becomes the child's own, right? That's something that is necessary. And so anybody who's been baptized as an infant, once they come to the age of reason, they're going to have to continue in that confession of faith that was initially confessed by the parents and the church, but then on an individual basis as they come to use intellect and will. What do you think of that, Andrea?
I mean, wow. That's a lot of detail. I'm going to have to let him listen to the podcast or the Facebook Live again.
Yes. I would highly encourage you to do that. And I tried my best to be very clear about it so that you can follow the reasoning, right? So when you listen back and you listen carefully, you're going to say, okay, infant doesn't have life of heaven. Baptism gives life of heaven. I want to give my child, the life of heaven. That's basically what it boils down to.
Andrea, that brings us to the break, which I have got to take, but thank you very much for the call. I don't know if we've ever sent you why we're Catholic, but if your husband is considering the RCIA and coming into the Catholic Church, I'm sure it would be helpful. So just hang on and Edgar will give that book to you if we haven't given it to you already. We'll take a break and be right back with more Open Forum with Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Watch the EWTN series, specials, events, and news streaming live from anywhere in the world. Streaming is available on the EWTN app for Apple, Android, and Amazon devices. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Carlo Broussard is our guest. I talked about his books, but Sunday Catholic Word is Carlo's podcast. It's the only podcast that looks at the Sunday Mass readings and focuses on the details that are relevant to explaining and defending the Catholic faith. You can get it at SundayCatholicWord.com, SundayCatholicWord.com, or wherever you get your podcasts, you can find it there. It covers all three, or is in the process of covering all 3 years in the cycle of the Sunday readings. And right now, right in the middle, almost halfway through, year B.
Yep. So coming up this Sunday, I think that's going to be the fourth Sunday of Easter, if I got that correct. We'll be looking at a few details, two details coming from the first reading that's in Acts 4, 8 through 12. We're going to talk about Peter the Rock and thus the papacy, right? That's a topic that arises from the text when Peter's declaring to the leaders of the people and the elders, he's proclaiming that Jesus is the chief cornerstone. Well, wait a minute. If Jesus is the chief cornerstone, how can you Catholics say that Peter is the rock of Matthew 16, 18? The interpretation of Matthew 16, 18 seems to conflict with what Peter says in Acts 4, right? And so that's a common stock Protestant objection to our interpretation of Peter the rock in Matthew 16, 18. So I deal with that topic in this forthcoming episode. I also talk about Jesus's divinity. That comes up in the reading from Acts chapter 4, verses 8 through 12. And then in the gospel in John 10, 11 through 18, yet again, we have Jesus's divinity and Peter's role as the first pope. So a lot of papacy stuff coming up in the fourth the readings for the fourth Sunday of Easter, because in John 10, Jesus is talking about the one shepherd. And that's clear indication in light of the Old Testament, interpreting that as in reference to Jesus, that he is Yahweh. He is God made flesh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But then he talks about this one shepherd where there's going to be one fold of both Jews and Gentiles. And that on a secondary level can also apply to Peter, who declares that the Gentiles can enter into the fold. And thus you have this one shepherd, Peter, and Jesus tells us that in John 21, 15 through 17, tend my sheep, feed my sheep, right? So you have one shepherd governing both Jews and Gentiles. So you have a polyvalent meaning there in John 10. So all of that and more for this upcoming episode of the Sunday Catholic Word of the fourth Sunday of Easter year B. It's going to be a blast.
SundayCatholicWord.com or just check Sunday Catholic Word wherever you get your podcasts. Let's go to Susie, who is in Quincy, Illinois, listening on 91.1 FM. Susie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. So I'm a science-minded person, and my family, we all are, and I have a 15-year-old son who asked me a really good question that kind of stumped me, so I'm hoping you can help.
Okay.
Based on the Bible and the fossil records, I believe that there was sentient life that had existed on Earth before Adam and Eve, and that their children left the Garden of Eden and married other humans. So, and I don't know what kind of life those creatures would have led, but I'm curious if you thought that they would have felt pain or fear, and if so, why would there have been pain or fear in an unfallen world?
So the answer to the first question is yes, they would have experienced pain and fear even before the fall. And the reason is because we as, like, that's consistent. Let me just say it like this. That understanding of animals experiencing pain and fear before the fall is consistent with Catholic interpretation of divine revelation, precisely because we do not teach, the Catholic Church does not teach, that all death and suffering was absent for all creatures before the fall. The church only teaches that death entered into human history subsequent to the fall. That would allow for non-humans, non-rational animals, to be experiencing suffering and death. And you can check out paragraph 310 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The Catechism talks about how God, in his infinite wisdom and goodness, he could have done it some other way, but he chose to do it this way, to create a world in what the Catechism calls a state of journeying toward its ultimate perfection. And within this plan, the Catechism talks about how there's a process of becoming, right? A becoming that involves the appearance of certain things and the disappearance of others. The existence of the more perfect alongside the less perfect. And here's the key, both constructive and destructive forces of nature. With physical good, there exists also physical evil. And that's like suffering and death for corporeal beings, bodily beings like you and me and the animals, as long as creation has not reached its perfection. So that's paragraph 310. So the Catechism is affirming, Susie, that part of God's plan with this material world was that it would be journeying to a state of perfection, which means it involves suffering and death. And this would apply in the context even before the fall, because the Catechism goes on in paragraph 400 to state that death makes its entrance into human history with the fall of Adam. And so we believe as Catholics that physical evil, suffering and death for corporeal beings and particularly animals, was present in, you know, on this earth even before the fall of Adam. Now, your second question as to why God would do that, why would God create this world with suffering and death for corporeal beings? Well, there is a bit of a mystery here as to why God did it this way rather than some other way, because he could, Susie, he could create physical beings and work a miracle, a perpetual miracle, and preserve them from death, as he will for us physical beings at the end of time, and preserving us from death. He could do that. But in this situation, Susie, he will to relate to physical beings according to their nature. What do I mean by that? Well, it's part and parcel of material things to break apart. They're composed of parts, and so they break apart. That just belongs to physical things. Physical things are with sentient beings, they're subject to pain, and eventually they're going to corrupt and they're going to die. And so God in his infinite wisdom willed a material world where you have material things that according to their natural mode of being or existence, they are subject to pain for these non-rational animals and death. And so God wills to relate to them as such and order it to some good within the created whole, the whole plan of things. We might not be able to see that good, but we know that there is a good. And so that's about as far as we can go, Susie, concerning the why question, material world with material beings naturally subject to death, and why God doesn't perform a perpetual miracle to preserve them from death. We don't know it yet, but on the other side of the veil, we may get some insight in the beatific vision as to the rationale, as to what sort of goodness, what particular aspect of God's divine goodness does this material world and material beings manifest. St. Thomas Aquinas, I'll finish with this, Susie, and I'll get your response. St. Thomas Aquinas would say that having a variety of beings in the universe to where you have non-living beings and living beings, and among the living beings, you have purely material things that are not sentient, like vegetables and plants, and then to have sentient beings like non-rational animals and then rational animals, that sort of hierarchy, even within the physical world, is manifesting God's goodness and his power in a beautiful way. And with that hierarchy, more perfect with less perfect, a hierarchy of physical beings subject to natural decay and death, that is, even that itself is manifesting God's glory, because the material existence itself. So the bottom line answer, Susie, is that it's part and parcel of material beings to suffer and to die. Given that God wills material beings within a material universe, it's reasonable for him to allow those material beings to function according to their natural mode and end up decaying and dying and experiencing pain and even, as you said, fear. What do you think of that, Susie?
I think that's amazing. I think it's really awesome that the Catholic Church has a statement on that even. I need to look that up, about journeying towards this ultimate perfection. That's really neat.
Yeah, paragraph 310 in the Catechism. A nice little summary there, but it's loaded and packed with a lot of meaning there and a lot of presuppositions, right, that are going into that statement about what we believe about the universe coming forth from the Creator even before the fall.
Thanks, Susie.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I do have one little thought I wanted to.
Yeah, throw it out. Yeah, go ahead.
So in Genesis, it says on day six that in the garden that animals were given like plants to eat, green plants to eat. And so in my mind, I guess I thought that in the perfect world that they wouldn't eat each other.
Right.
But it does seem like before that they had records that they did. So was there a meaning there in day six when that's put into the Bible there? Is there a meaning there, or am I just reading into it?
Yeah, well, you know, we as Catholics are permitted to take various details of the creation story to be metaphorical, to convey some historical truth. So there you could have a historical truth as God providing the animals with food, not necessarily to convey the idea that the animals, all animals were non-carnivorous, right? They weren't carnivores. They were only eating plants. And so that would be one possible interpretation of that, that this is somehow metaphorical and there's a historical truth embedded within that metaphor. It could be something else that the author is trying to convey to us that we're not quite sure on, but in no way would we have to conclude that the creation story is contradicting science and the scientific narrative of animal life here on Earth, because we're not required to take every single detail in a literalistic way, as if the author were trying to convey some scientific truth about non-rational animals and exactly what they were eating. That would be an assumption that we would challenge. And so given that freedom for us as Catholics in interpreting the creation story, allowing for the author to be using metaphors within the creation story to convey certain historical truths, we can see that there would be no discrepancy, no need for a discrepancy or a conflict between the scientific narrative and the creation story.
All right, Susie?
Very good. Very good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the call. It's cool that you have a science-minded family. I don't know if you all listen to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, but I would recommend some of those episodes for the family. I think you'll love them. And call back. It'll be nice to talk with you again. Carla Broussard is our guest. It's Open Forum. We'll be right back with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Father Weiss discloses the new Eve foretold in the Old Testament and revealed in the New. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you scared to talk about abortion? Don't worry, almost everyone is. You can overcome this fear as Trent Horn shows in the newly revised and expanded second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. With a little knowledge and a few proven techniques, you can become a bold and effective apologist for life. Visit shop.catholic.com to order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life and never again be afraid to speak up. Also available at good Catholic bookstores.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome to a journey of faith, wisdom, and understanding. I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, and I invite you to join me tomorrow for Beacon of Truth on most of these EWTN stations. Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Carla Broussard is our guest. His podcast is the Sunday Catholic Word. You can find it at sundaycatholicword.com. And one of the fun things we get to do around here is welcome Thomas the TikTok Engine, and he's back. Thomas the TikTok Engine, you have a question from TikTok?
I do. Yeah, I have a question from TikTok taken from our own comment section.
Do you have to cool down from the stuff you encounter on TikTok? Or you seem like a pretty cool character.
I used to at the beginning of my job, and then I developed this little trick where I just decided to not care what people said on the internet.
Oh, you kind of it's a kind of a chosen disinterest. Like I'm just not gonna get emotionally involved with that.
Yeah, yeah. Other people might just call it a deadening of the intellect, but you know, I like to dress it up in certain terms.
Or maybe you're deadening the emotion so that the intellect can engage.
That's a nicer way to put it. Let's go with that one. I like that one.
Put things nicely. I like that one. That's my job. Put things nicely. All right, Thomas, the TikTok engine. You got a TikTok question for Carlo, I assume?
I do, yeah. This was taken from the comment section of one of our videos. Carlo, this person says, as a Catholic, this person's Catholic. This kind of question usually comes from our Protestant friends, but he says, as a Catholic, I'm curious why we are allowed to have statues and paintings when it says not to make any idol or icon. And I assume by it there he means the Bible.
Yeah, so the Bible would probably be Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, where God talks about having no graven images. And the key word there in the question, Thomas, would be not making idols. And that's clearly what's going on in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, whenever God says, you shall have no graven images. As I point out in my book, Meeting the Protestant Challenge, I have a chapter on this. The Hebrew word that's used there for graven images is pasel. And elsewhere throughout the Old Testament, whenever pasel is used, like for example, in Isaiah chapter 44, verse 9, it's used in reference to idols. It's not simply an image or a image. An image. It's referring to an idol. And the context of the prohibition bears this out, because in verse 3 of Exodus chapter 20, it says, you shall have no other gods before me. That's the tee-up, right? That's the first commandment. And it's right after, and then right after the passage in question, we read, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. So you have, don't have any false gods before me. Don't make pasel, graven images. You shall not bow down to them and serve them. The implication being there, worship them. So what God is prohibiting are images that are seen as or used for idol worship. That's what God is prohibiting. So the thou shalt not make graven images is actually a part of the very first commandment that forbids idolatry, forbids the worship of false gods. And so given that that's what the Bible is talking about, the Catholic practice and even the non-Catholic practice, right, the Christian practice, especially among our Orthodox brethren, of having images of beings in heaven, both angelic and human, and even images of God in light of the incarnation of God made man, Jesus Christ, those images are simple reminders of the heavenly realities and calling us to conform our lives to those heavenly realities and live in accord with them, because we're ordered to that heavenly reality of sainthood ourselves. And so that's the very purpose of the religious imagery that we have within our sanctuaries, within our churches, of whether it be icons or statues, what have you. That's the purpose. They are not considered, nor should they be considered, as idols to be served or worshiped. If someone were to treat a statue or an icon or an image of anybody as a deity, as a god in and of itself, as somehow emanating power forth from it in order for me to have blessings in my life, well, then that would fall, that would violate the first commandment in Exodus chapter 20. How's that?
Can I just say something? To everyone on TikTok, nailed it.
Nailed it.
Carla, nailed it. Take that, TikTok.
Yeah, this will settle it once and for all.
TikTok should just all become Catholic.
Well, I don't know about that.
No, nothing settles it once and for all.
Here's a good point. You know, it's interesting that you bring up that question, Thomas, because, you know, in apologetical circles, that's like, man, that question's been asked a million times and it's been answered a million and one. But it still weighs heavy on the hearts and minds of people. You know, for us as apologists at Catholic Answers, as quote unquote elementary as that question might sound or appear to be, for many people it's not. And it still weighs heavy on the hearts and minds of folks. And so this is why I'm going to address that and many more questions about the saints in my forthcoming book, published hopefully this fall by Catholic Answers Press, on defending the invocation and veneration of the saints. So stay tuned, folks.
Did he just nail it and then turn it into an ad?
That was smooth.
That was very smooth.
That was very nicely done.
Yeah, man. I've been around Tim Staples for quite a few years now. I'm kind of learning the show here.
Picked up some tips and tricks from that. Well, thanks for the answer, and thanks for the forthcoming
Thomas.
Content we're going to get.
Thomas, before I let you go, people are praying for Mrs. TikTok Engine, Teresa. Is she still with child, or the child has not come yet?
Yeah, unless some really fast developments have taken place over the last few minutes. No, the child has not come yet.
But we're getting close to the due date.
Due date has already passed, as a matter of fact. So he's officially, you know, overdue. The waiting game really
begins. He's officially a procrastinator, Thomas.
He is just like his dad.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Carlo. Thanks, Zach.
Ava.
All right, Thomas.
Our good friend Ava in Ontario, Canada, watching on YouTube. Welcome back, Ava.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, we love it when you call, Ava. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
All right. So a family friend went to confession, and she has a hard time getting around because she needs oxygen tanks. So she has a hard time getting around. But after confession, she realized the priest didn't give her a penance. So she went to him afterwards, and she asked him about it. And he said that he figured her going was enough of a penance. But she was wondering if it's a valid confession since he didn't give her a penance and he didn't tell her during the confession that her being there was a penance.
Yes, the answer is yes. That is a valid confession. Absolution was granted. Penance is not essential to the sacrament of confession itself, because the sacrament of confession provides absolution of the guilt of sin. Penance has to do with making up for the past forgiven sin. It has to do with the remnants of sin that we take care of through acts of charity, unhealthy attachments to creaturely goods, debt of temporary punishment due for past forgiven sin. Notice the emphasis, for past forgiven sin. The implication being that the guilt of sin has already been remitted. Therein kicks in penance, right? So even though you don't get the penance, the guilt of the sin can still be remitted through the absolution that the priest gives the penitent. Now, if that's assuming that the individual was guilty of mortal sin. If the individual is not guilty of mortal sin and was only guilty of venial sin, well, then that confession itself was simply an act of penance, because the guilt of venial sin, presumably, would have already been remitted by any act of contrition that the individual would have prayed or offered up to God in her heart and mind. And so the confession itself would simply be taking care of remnants of sin, not the guilt of sin. And so there would literally be no need to be concerned, even in this case, for the remission of the guilt of sin, assuming that it was just venial sins that she was confessing and she wasn't guilty of the mortal sin. So regardless if it was the guilt of mortal sin or the guilt of venial sin, she need not worry. Confession was good.
Okay, Ava?
Okay, thank you. But priests often will give penance for venial sins as well, right?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Because the priest, you know, and that's a good thing, because we really don't know if, like, all guilt of venial sin is completely remitted as I'm confessing my sins at that particular moment, right? So the penance can be given for any guilt of venial sin that is remitted through the confession. But even if there's no guilt of venial sin remitted through the absolution, because there's none there to be remitted, the penance still is given as a further act of penance to take care of any past forgiven sins and the remnants of sin in order to pursue holiness, grow in holiness, and, you know, knock off some of those things that would be purified in the time of purgatory.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ava, it's always nice to talk with you. Thank you very much. We'll take a break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
He is honored as the newest doctor of the church with the title Doctor of Unity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
A second century bishop, theologian, and martyr, St. Irenaeus of Lyon was a fierce defender of the faith against the heresy of Gnosticism. He reminded Catholics of every century that heresy cloaks itself in appealing guise, but that the antidote is the sound teaching handed down by the apostles.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Carla Broussard is our guest, and Robin is in Michigan watching on Facebook. We're glad you're here, Robin. Go ahead with your question for Carla.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is more in reference to what was said in the first hour, but it was concerning fasting and that not to fast to an extreme. And my question is, I've read St. Catherine of Siena's works. You know, I'm not questioning her sainthood or why she's a doctor of the church, but part of her story was a fasting to an extreme, mm-hmm. to where she was ordered to eat. So what is the balance, you know, between examples like that and not harming yourself through ascetic practices? Because her life was shortened due to that, and she died at 33. And if you read the account of her death, of the condition of her body, and that it's like somebody that was basically had starved to death.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm just saying.
Yeah, Robin.
I'm not talking about sainthood or her holiness or anything.
Right.
I'm just saying that.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Yeah, this is an interesting question. I'll be honest, I would have to think about it a little bit more to give a more definitive judgment on it. I don't think I ever gave much thought to it. One possible path forward would be to say that, just because she's a saint doesn't mean every pious action that she engaged in was flawless without fault. You could take a path forward and say, well, maybe some of the things that she did were a bit too extreme, did involve fault, and when advised to correct it, she obeyed and corrected it. And so that's an example of virtue and obedience and holiness, etc. Another possible path forward, Robin, would be that maybe some people have a very special calling by God in an individual circumstance to impose an extreme amount of displeasure for the body to make reparation, not only for one's own sins, but for the sins of others. And that may very well be in the case of Catherine of Siena, could be for other people as well. There would have to be some sort of confirmation for the individual of mystical experiences, private revelations perhaps, to confirm that that God is actually calling an individual to engage in such extreme forms of physical displeasure, ordered toward, not for the sake of physical displeasure in and of itself, because that would be immoral, but ordered toward a greater good of manifesting something in the divine will, namely the salvation of souls, perhaps. And so those would be two possible routes that we could take there. Now, I'm not an expert on Catherine of Siena. To be honest, I haven't read her life story. I'm not very well read in the lives of the saints. But those would be at least two principles that I would begin to articulate as I would try to analyze the example of Catherine of Siena or some other example. So I don't know. What do you think of that? That's about as far as I can go on that question.
Well, I mean, considering the time she lived in, that was the dumpster fire of the 14th century, which is what she lived in, and the Pope was in France, and she was trying to encourage the Pope to go back to Rome, and all the other things that were going on in that century, which is like a big dumpster fire, really, when you look at it. I, the second part of it, that played a part in what, the time she lived in.
Yeah, sure. And those times called for greater measures of sacrifice. And like I said, on the second path moving forward on this could be that God gives her a special calling to engage in extreme forms of mortification ordered toward that greater good of, of bringing about order within the church and salvation, et cetera. And we have to say that that's a possibility, because that would be in conformity with our Blessed Lord himself, who went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights and fasting.
and an extreme version of it. And that was exercising his human will and putting his human body under such duress of physical displeasure that was unique to our Lord at that time. But that can be a unique calling for some individuals, where God will provide the grace needed to accomplish that goal, order to accomplish that feat of physical displeasure to such an extreme amount, order toward greater goods. And so this is why, whenever we're talking about fasting, it's always a good thing to try to find a really smart, holy priest who can give you the spiritual counsel that you need in discerning the degrees of fasting that you think you are called to. We always need that other voice to help us discern whether this inner voice of, I should fast at this degree of extremity, of extreme effectiveness or degree, extreme degree, we always need another voice to try to assess that inner voice as to whether we're thinking correctly here and we're acting prudently. So that would be my recommendation for anybody listening and considering the degrees of fasting that they want to engage in.
All right. Robin?
No, that's totally wise advice. I totally agree with it. Thank you for taking my call.
I think Warren Carroll wrote a book about the 12th century called The Greatest Century. And Robin, I see a book in your future called The Dumpster Fire Century. You could just write a whole book about All right, I got to keep moving. Actually, we've got people on the line. But thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate the call. Andrea in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You're up next, Andrea. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Very well, yes. Thank you.
Okay. So I wanted to know if the use of cannabis medicinally, like, for example, I have ADHD and anxiety, and it helps me shut down and enjoy myself and just relax before I go to bed. Just wondering if this would be a sin, and if so, why? And especially if used in moderation, like alcohol, how would it be a sin?
Okay, Andrea, thank you. I'm sorry that you have the anxiety and ADD.
Yeah.
But, Carlo?
All right. So, Andrea, I am not aware, nor do I think there is any, and maybe, Sai, you can help me out with this, any particular magisterial teaching on this to where I would have to, like, bind your conscience in order to conform to the magisterium's teaching on this. So we have to address it from a principled nature through just thinking through the issue. So in principle, you have a substance that's being utilized for a medicinal purpose, okay? So in principle, technically speaking, we could say that in principle, it's possible that that cannabis or marijuana could be used in a medicinal way, right? Now, the key question is going to be with regard to the empirical data as to the medicinal effect that this substance is alleged to bring about versus the bad effects that science would tell us this substance could also bring about in those side effects. And so whenever we analyze it, we would have to assess the proportion between those good effects, the medicinal effects, and those bad effects. And if the bad effects outweigh the medicinal effects, well, then it would be inappropriate to even use that substance for medicinal purposes or goals. Now, here's the problem. Andrea, right?
Yeah.
Man, this is the second Andrea of the night. I had to do a double check there. So here's the problem, Andrea. Unfortunately, I haven't done enough research in the empirical data in order to give you an answer as to whether the side effects or the bad effects of cannabis outweighs the good medicinal effects such that you would need to avoid the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes even. So I simply have to plead ignorance here, and I'm going to have to punt on this to an individual who has done some research. So if you just Google a scholar by the name of Timothy Shaio, that's H-S-A-I-O, just Google Timothy Shaio and marijuana or cannabis for medicinal purposes or whatever have you, his articles will come up where he has written some articles where I know the conclusion that he arrives at, and I know he cites the sources for the empirical data, But I've never traced the research trail, followed the research trail in order to make my own conclusions about it. But at least that's a resource that you could at least get started on to begin inquiring as to whether you should be using it even for medicinal purposes. So notice the difference between the principle part of the question and whether in fact it's actually going to be moral for you to use it for medicinal purposes. So that's how I would articulate that question. And unfortunately, I can't give you a definitive answer on that because I just don't have the facts in my journey of knowledge.
Okay, Andrea?
Okay. Also, really quick, something like in the Bible, it talks about drunkenness. I'm wondering if it's talking about like compared to getting like tipsy rather than like being addicted to it. Like, I don't know, like what drunkenness would like, what's the definition of that, like, biblically?
Yeah, good question, Andrea. So that would refer to an intentional overindulgence in alcoholic beverages in order to limit your capacities as a human being of your reason and your free will. So if you voluntarily use that substance and overindulge in it, knowing that it's going to intoxicate you such that you can no longer function properly as a human being, that's what we would define as drunkenness. Now, that's going to be dependent upon the your ability to of how much alcohol you can take in without getting to that state, right? So it will depend on individual people and their alcohol tolerance, but we can define it generally as this willful, voluntarily overindulgence in alcoholic beverages such that you're limiting your capacity to function appropriately as a human being with your reason and your free will. Now, you said tipsy. Well, we have to define tipsy. What do you mean by tipsy? Or is your reasoning capacities incapacitated? Is your free will limited by what you define as tipsy? Or are you just kind of starting to feel a little relaxed due to the alcoholic beverage to where you still have full control of your reason and your free will? That would not constitute drunkenness. And once you have that self-knowledge of getting to that point, it would be appropriate and moral to stop so that you do not overindulge. And that also distinguishes it from accidental drunkenness, right? If you don't have an awareness of your alcohol tolerance and you start sipping some wine, and then all of a sudden, like, you've lost your reasoning capacities, well, then that would be accidental, and that wouldn't constitute the sin of drunkenness. And this reasoning, the same sort of reasoning, Andrea, can apply with the use of cannabis and or marijuana, because that substance can and does bring about an incapacitation of the full use of reason and your free will. And so that question arises, well, how much, to what degree does this substance bring about the incapacitation of the free will? And then we also have to take into consideration the addictive qualities of the substance and what it might do to the brain. Again, that's an appeal to empirical data that I simply don't have in front of me in order to direct your attention to. So that's what I would say in regard to that.
Is that helpful to you, Andrea?
Yes, 100%. That's like the best answer I've heard to that question. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I've been working on it for a long time. Oh, it was Carlo that gave the answer. I apologize. Andrea, I've got a little book that I'd love to send you. It's called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you'd like a copy of that book, we'd be happy to send it to you for free. Just let Carlo know, and he'll get that book out to you. Thanks, Andrea. And we'll say a prayer for you. I will say a prayer for you, Andrea, while you deal with the anxiety and ADHD. That's very difficult. I know that's very difficult. I know some other people who struggle with those particular ailments. And I don't take them lightly. It sounds like you're not taking them lightly. I hope you will get whatever help you need to deal with them. Thanks, Andrea. Carlo Broussard's been our guest. Can you believe an hour went by? When you're doing all the work, my hour goes so quickly, Carlo. It just zips by.
Yeah, it flew by, man. But you know what? I had a great time. I hope you had a great time. I hope our listeners had a great time. And I'm grateful for all the good calls today and the good spirit with which everybody asked the question. It's always great to talk to folks.
We're getting closer and closer, by the way. People should know this, to having to call Carlo, Dr. Carlo Broussard. I don't know when the defense of the It's coming. Is it coming
June 10th?
Oh, June 10th. All
June
right.
10th.
Put that on your prayer
calendar.
I got
a date, man.
You got a date, June 10th. All right. Thanks, Carlo. That'll do it for us. I don't know what we're doing tomorrow. I know we're doing a great show tomorrow, but I'm looking in the booth. Nobody's telling me. Oh, are we doing something wonderful tomorrow? What is tomorrow? Oh, flannel panel. Why, yes, we are doing a great show tomorrow. Flannel panel, news of the world from a Catholic perspective tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live. See you then. God willing.